This week, in episode 266 of the RV Podcast, we meet a remarkable RVing couple who teach us what it means to never give up.
Circumstances are never just right, are they, Mike?
Never.
Even if you go out and buy an RV, there are going to be problems with your first RV and your second RV and your last RV. So there will always be issues and there will always be things that could be different or better. But the question is, can you be comfortable? And the answer is yes, we can. Can you deal with the adversity? There are many ways that you can overcome adversity.
Welcome, fellow travelers. It's time for another episode of the RV Podcast.
Answering your questions, sharing tips, suggesting great trips and off-the-beaten-path adventures, and always staying on top of the RV lifestyle news you need to know about with great interviews and inside industry information.
Here's your hosts, award-winning journalists Mike and Jennifer Wendland.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 266 of the RV Podcast. And this episode is being released to you on a special day, on the day before Halloween 2019. And this is for you, this program. Even if your RV is still in your dreams, maybe you have a trailer, maybe you have a motorhome, maybe a towable trailer, maybe it's a tent. And like I say, maybe you're just dreaming. Well, here we talk about getting out there, enjoying God's amazing creation, meeting interesting people, boondocking. We intend to be your guide to freedom and fun through RV travel. So thanks for putting us in your ears this week. In a few minutes, in our Interview of the Week segment, we're going to meet Len and Sherry Johnson, a remarkable California couple with quite a story to tell. It's a story of a devastating injury from an airplane crash and a determination to embrace the RV lifestyle afterwards, despite a lot of obstacles. You are going to be inspired by this couple coming up in the Interview of the Week. But also this week, we have lots of RV news, RV tips, and an off the beaten path report from our friends, the Burkitts. But first, my lifelong traveling companion and my bride, Jennifer. Hi, my dear.
Hello, my Michael.
Well, this episode being released, as we said, on the day before Halloween 2019. And it's a time that many or most of the campgrounds in the northern states and provinces have pretty much been shut down for the season. This is also the time that the first wave of the annual snowbird migration gets underway when, you know, the first frost and the early snow flurries start flying up north. Sends tens of thousands of RVing snowbirds flocking to southern states like Florida, where we are right now, and Arizona.
And then the second wave happens right after Christmas as snowbirding RVers who stayed home with family for the holidays head south to take advantage of those snowbird campground special seasonal rates, typically from January 1st through March 31st.
Now, for those who do remain in the colder states, we shouldn't have to tell you this, but let us make this clear that now is the time to make sure your RV is winterized, draining out the water, running antifreeze through the plumbing system. And, you know, there are about as many different ways to winterize an RV as there are RVs out there. But if you are new to all of this, or maybe you're looking for some different ideas, head over to our RV Lifestyle channel on YouTube, where we have put together a whole playlist of videos related to winterizing. We'll put a link in the show notes, and the show notes for this episode can be found on our travel blog, which is rvlifestyle.com/266. And while we're talking about that YouTube channel, let's remind everybody that the best way to stay up to date on our videos and our special YouTube reports is to subscribe to that YouTube channel. When you do subscribe, be sure and click the little bell icon that you see there, and then you'll be notified whenever we post new material, which we typically do throughout the week. So we'll put a link to that as well on our show notes page, which again is rvlifestyle.com/266.
We're coming to you this week from Florida, where we'll be until about Thanksgiving time. And among other things, we're using this time to travel Florida's Gulf Coast, pretty much from Naples through Tallahassee. Thank you, Bo.
For those of you who wonder where Bo is,
he's here.
He's right here at our feet, and I guess he didn't get...
Maybe he wants to go north.
Yeah, he's probably hearing
what he's saying. He heard that talk about snow and frost.
Don't say snow.
He knows and everything. Snow and he doesn't want to travel to Naples up through Tallahassee.
Anyway, we're
so
in
we're
Florida.
Doing some research for one of those 7-day adventure guides, and we're actually planning two of them on Florida, one on the Gulf side or the West Coast, and the other on the Atlantic or the East Coast. We hope to have those guides ready after the holidays, and they'll be joining our growing library of RV travel guides.
We have five of those guides that are out, 7-day adventure guides. They're meant, you can do them in 7 days if you go fast, but they're basically 7 different adventure type stops. So it saves you a lot of work. We tell you where to stay. We have them for the Michigan Upper Peninsula, for Utah, Colorado, Yellowstone National Park, the Adirondacks. And we also have a guide on boondocking and also how to buy an RV. So we'll put a link in those in the show notes as well. But we hope to get those Florida guides out right around the first of the year. Bo is now pushing his head between the two of us. We did an interview. I think he does this whenever we start talking, because we did an interview on another podcast last week.
Yeah.
And we just no sooner started talking about that than he started barking again,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he started barking.
So, for no reason that I can tell.
Yeah, he can't even see out the windows right now, so there isn't any reason that we can tell. And so besides the research for the Florida RV travel guides, we've been traveling around in our RV, visiting small southern towns and digging into the history of how they got their names. We'll have a video on it in a couple of weeks, but it was another reminder to me about how much better it is traveling off the interstate on those two-lane roads. They've forced us to slow down and take time as we travel through those small towns. And they all have a story to tell, and it's always fascinating, the things that to see and to do.
This part of the podcast is brought to you by Dish Outdoors, which lets RVers literally pay as they go. You don't have to sign up for any long-term contract, just pay monthly, and you can watch HD satellite television from wherever you're camped with easy-to-set-up gear made with the RVer in mind. We are thrilled with our Dish Outdoor system. We have the new satellite receiver called Wally that's made for RV travelers. Very small, very compact, super easy to set up. We also have the brand new Dish Playmaker portable satellite antenna. It does it automatically. It just turn it on and it searches and then it locks into the strongest satellite. So you don't have to be up there in the rain or in the wind or in the bad weather trying to point your dish. This does it all automatically. And the whole system is geared just for RVers. And what they do that's really nice is you don't have to have a subscription at home for it. You can just get this gear and pay for it month to month. So or if you're going to be gone for 2 months, you pay for 2 months. If it's a month, just pay for a month. If it's 12 months, you can pay for 12 months. But it's a really nice system for RVers, because the other systems out there make you pay long-term rates. They make it difficult if you're not already a subscriber. Dish Outdoors has this whole gear set up for RVers, and it's really neat. You don't need that dish at home, again, to get Dish Outdoors. They have an introductory price, and it's a pretty neat deal. The normal bundle for the Wally receiver and the Dish Playmaker, this gear is only $348. That is a great price, but we can make it even greater, because if you use the coupon code RVLifestyle at checkout, they'll take an additional $50 off that. So you can get that whole bundle for just $298 with that RV Lifestyle discount, and that is amazing. If you're looking for more information about all of this, just go to rvlifestyle.com/dish.
News. Mike's got news. RV news. Travel news. Inside information and trends that shape the RV lifestyle. Here's the RV news of the week.
Well, as this episode is being recorded, the RV community is intensely following the disappearance of a New Hampshire couple and the discovery of two bodies near where their truck and travel trailer were last known to be camping near Padre Island, Texas. The truck and the trailer were later spotted, I think, on some surveillance video being driven across the border into Mexico and someone other than the owners was at the wheel. Now, there have been at least 5 other disappearance cases in the same general area this fall, and police near Corpus Christi, Texas, are awaiting a complete forensic examination before releasing the names of the male and the female bodies that were discovered this weekend, buried in a sand dune on the beach. But it obviously is closely being followed by the RV community. Some of the friends of this couple are members of our RV Lifestyle Facebook group, and our hearts go out to them. And we'll keep watching this as well. But you can pray along with the family for a safe return of this couple. But a pretty grim discovery of the 2 bodies near where they were known to be camping.
Much of the country experienced extreme weather this last weekend, with strong winds up to 80 or 90 miles per hour expected in California, further fanning the already raging wildfires and resulting in massive power outages. Meanwhile, in the southeast, starting around Mobile, Alabama, and up all the way up into Michigan, strong winds and heavy rains brought down trees and inches of rain throughout the weekend. We hope wherever you find yourself, you're safe. And perhaps this is a good time for all of us to make sure we are watching the weather. We'll put a link to some helpful weather apps we recommend in the show notes for this episode at rvlifestyle.com/266. That's rvlifestyle.com/266.
Yeah, story that came out of Las Vegas this week about a woman being arrested after she apparently drove her RV into a casino in Las Vegas, seriously injuring a janitor who was inside. 50-year-old woman behind the wheel had been kicked out of the Cannery Casino and was apparently angry about that. And she then, police say, intentionally drove her RV into the entrance of the casino, where she hit the 66-year-old janitor who and trapped him underneath her vehicle. He was being treated at a hospital, last we heard. But she is in police custody, and police still not sure exactly what set her all off, other than she got mad.
I wonder if alcohol was involved.
I don't think you have to wonder too much.
The National Park Service rescinded an order that would have allowed off-road vehicles into national parks in Utah 1 week before it was to take effect. ORV advocates were disappointed, saying if state laws permit ORVs to go anywhere, that should include national parks. But conservation groups and others were thrilled at the reversal, saying that the vehicles already have tens of thousands of miles of dirt and other roads in Utah to ride, and permitting them in the state's national parks would have been impossible to police, opening the park up to potentially irreversible damage.
Well, back in mid-September, we shared the annual monarch butterfly migration story and how the popular flying creatures were being seen en masse in southern Canada and northern continental U.S. Well, they followed us down to Florida. Now they're being spotted in large numbers in Georgia, in Florida, Texas, Mississippi, and other southern locations. The annual migration of the monarchs. And if you find yourself camping in these areas this week, see if there are any festivals or special events planned. A lot of communities do that with the return of the monarchs. Or you can check on the show notes at rvlifestyle.com/266. Scroll down to our news of the week, and under the story, we'll put a link on the migration, and you can see where it is at this present time.
Live on the West Coast and interested in doing some winter camping? The state of Washington recently released its list of more than 100 parks that will remain open this winter for camping or outdoor activities. As many longtime readers know, and listeners, we are big fans of winter camping. To see a video of a winter camping trip we made last January in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, check the show notes.
And we're also doing that again. We're going up in January. We talked about that, I think, every week, telling everybody about our big winter camp out. But we're going to have some fun up there. I think we've got over 50 people already signed up for that.
Awesome.
All right, that's the news of the week. And this part of the podcast brought to you by our friends at Rad Power Bikes. Rad Power Bikes is America's number one e-bike brand, offering direct-to-consumer pricing on powerful premium electric bikes, and now with free shipping. Rad Power Bikes are built for everything, and they're priced for everyone. They have a series of different e-bike models that fit just about every possible variety of rider wants and needs you can find. All of their models can reach 20 miles an hour with zero pedaling. And they also give all the riders a choice to ride pedal-free with throttle, utilizing five different levels of pedal assist for an added boost or a combination of the two. Rad Power bikes are perfect for people who want to get back into riding, or maybe you're recovering from surgery or injury. Maybe you're just looking for a little extra boost to keep up with friends and family and to make sure you're still out there enjoying it all. Riders can travel between 20 and 40 miles on a single charge, and they're priced at often less than half the cost of comparable bikes on the market because that dealer retail markup chain is cut off. Now, they all have a great price, and they have great free shipping, which is a big deal, free shipping. But if you mention RV Lifestyle at checkout, they'll give you an additional $75 off. That's RV Lifestyle. Use that coupon code. You can visit them all at radpowerbikes.com.
Questions? You've got them. Mike and his network of RV reporters have the answers. Here's one of our questions of the week.
Hello, Mike and Jennifer. This is Mark Proger again from Austin, Texas. You may remember me. I called and left a question a good year or so ago, and you guys were very helpful, as well as many of your listeners. I wanted to ask a renewed question. We are just about to finally break ground on our RV park east of Austin. We've got all of our ducks in a row, but we're still making some last-minute decisions. So my question is pretty simple. How important is the pedestal? In other words, we can spend $1,000 on a pedestal that looks like a little lighthouse that I'm sure you've seen, or we can spend $250 on a more generic one and put that extra money into more trees or to other things. So we were curious to know what you and what your listeners thought about how important that pedestal is. Is that something that you deeply appreciate when a park has spent more money on that? Or is it something that is kind of no big deal to you one way or the other? Thank you so much. Love your show. Have now listened to dozens and dozens and dozens of your episodes, probably well over 100, and enjoy it every time. All right. God bless. Thanks.
I remember the call from Mark a year ago, and many of you, because Mark is building a campground, and he wanted to know what were the most important things that our listeners thought about, and he's incorporating your feedback, and there he is asking for some more information. When he opens that campground in Austin, Texas, we'll visit it. So Mark, make sure we know about it.
I sure hope that
we
can.
We will come there.
We want to come. We want to see it.
I feel like we have a vested interest.
Mm-hmm.
So he's asking you guys for more input, but we will offer ours. So he asked about pedestals.
What do you say?
I say, save the money. Buy another tree or two. I've seen these little catchy little, lighthouse. What's a lighthouse doing in the middle of Texas? You don't need one out there. So save that money. That's my advice. I mean, I'd rather see that extra, $1,000 if those things cost that much, those little, clever, little crafty looking pedestals, save it, put it in landscaping, put some bushes and trees and, maybe make the sites just a little bigger.
See, I was having trouble understanding pedestal. I was thinking.
Yeah, where you plug the electricity into.
Oh,
that little, it's normally just a little gray box,
I was thinking pad.
No.
Pad, but that's a pad.
The electric pedestal.
Oh, so just where you plug in?
Yeah.
They have it fancy or have it simple?
Yeah, the simple one, you just get a nice one. Now, the one thing that I would tell you when you get these pedestals is make sure it doesn't get rusty. Now, I know, just those standard little, I think they're a duck version. They got a little emblem of a duck on them, those little gray pedestals. One thing that always throws me for a halt is when I go in and I open it up and it's rusty, the gray part has gotten rusted because it's out in the elements, and inside I see cobwebs around the plugs and all that stuff. So when you clean out a site on a RV park, make sure you clean out those pedestals, get the cobwebs out, because it just tells me that if they don't maintain those, what else isn't maintained? So that's my one caveat on how important the pedestal is. And then, landscaping, man, I'm all for landscaping.
Yeah, and the fenced-in dog area, which I'm sure you have, and a pool.
Yep.
Maybe fun things, a slide or something on the pool. Of course, that probably raises the insurance rate.
Yeah, we were at a campground last week that had the best dog area we've ever seen. Most most of the KOAs now have canine little areas for exercise, but they're like, they're not much bigger than a prison cell. You know, they're really small.
And he knows prison cells. He used to cover crime.
Yeah, back in my old crime days.
Yeah, he used to spend a lot of time
in jail.
I was
a police reporter and corruption reporter for a long time.
Yeah, but some of his best fans were there.
They were, actually.
It's a captive audience.
They watch TV all the time. But and they were really always, every time we went in there, I remember one time I was covering a prison riot. And, I mean, it was sad. You know, it was a prison riot. And the prisoners saw us doing a live shot, and they all said, "Hey, it's Mike Wendell in the I." They all knew me out that Mike Wendell in the I team was my old name at, when I was at Channel 4 in Detroit, and they all knew who I was. And I said, "Settle down, guys." And they all were laughing at me, you know, but they were saying hi. They were very friendly. Anyway, I digress. When you build a place, an exercise place for dogs and animals.
How about an exercise place for people?
Yes, no, yes, I knew she was going
to
say that.
Yes, this one that we went to last week, they had a couple of treadmills and, you know, a rowing machine
now,
and a bike.
Here's how important that is. Would you, and I know there's a lot of people like Jennifer that are
that take,
you're a little nuttier that way, yeah, about being fit and stuff, but... But a lot of people take their fitness and their health very seriously. Would you choose, had two campgrounds and one of them had a workout area for humans and one didn't? Would you choose, would that
influence
you?
Of course I would go to the workout area for the person. And if you have a big room, like a rec room for people, if you have a screen or something and you have some kind of way to play videos where people can do some kind of, a couple of different aerobic programs, women like that.
Yeah, yeah. And
maybe the guys do too.
So save the money on the pedestal, Mark. Use it to buy more trees or make a little bigger area for dogs and invest in a treadmill and an elliptical machine and you'll get more people there.
We saw that at one campground where they had their rec room, they had videos and people went there and did their workouts and
yeah,
they all loved it.
You tend to find that at places that do a lot of snowbirds and
yeah,
seasonal
campers.
Yeah,
people are there for a long time.
But if you want people, give them the amenities that they're used to. You know, they find them in a hotel room, you should have the same stuff. Take care of your gear. So, Mark, when you open that campground, please let us know. We'd like to see it. All right, here's another question. Last week we talked about e-bikes, and here's a question from a listener about just that.
Hi, Mike and Jennifer. This is Susie calling from the road. My husband and I recently became full-time RVers. We've been listening to and enjoying your podcast for years. In fact, it may have actually helped us decide to hit the road. Our question is about e-bikes today. We first heard about them on your podcast. Now we've tried them and love them. We are very close to placing our order with Rad, but we've recently seen two examples of signs forbidding e-bikes on bike trails. Now we're concerned that we'll get rid of our standard bikes and find that we're not going to be able to use our e-bikes on bike paths. Have you encountered this? Thanks in advance for your podcast and for your response. Have a great day. Bye.
Thanks, Susie.
Hmm.
Well, we did just encounter that up on Mackinac Island. You're the one
yes,
who noticed that, right?
Mackinac Island, you can't ride e-bikes. And that's okay with me because the island's only, 8.3 miles around? There's not a lot of land there to ride your bikes. I mean, it'd be like having a little moped.
Yeah. Well, I did a little bit of research for it, and let me just kind of, without boring everybody, I'll put a link in the show notes, and you, those of you who have e-bikes, about where you can go. And a lot of this information comes from a really great sports shop called Pine Mountain Sports in Bend, Oregon. They sell e-bikes, and so they're not against e-bikes, but they really have a pretty good primer on where they're allowed, where they're not. Let's just talk about a pedal assist e-bike, which is what most of us are talking about. By federal law definition, it is a motorized vehicle, or it's not a motorized vehicle. It is not. By state law definition, in most places, it is a bicycle. And that's important to keep in mind, answers a lot of questions. You'll find that the Department of Transportation defines e-bikes as bicycles, but it is specific to roadway situations. For example, an e-bike is, by definition, is a bicycle when it comes to insurance. It means it's not required. And paved bike paths, in most cases, e-bikes are allowed, most of them, on paved bike paths. There are lots of legal places you can ride them, but on non-motorized mountain bike trails, single track trails. They are either prohibited by the people who maintain those trails or strongly discouraged. And you'll find that mountain bikers will get very angry about an e-bike on their trail. Many of our trails that RVers find are on Forest Service land, and the Forest Service has an e-bike ban on all of the trails, the dirt trails, where motorized use is not allowed. Now, dirt roads, specific ATV tracks, motorbike trails, they're all okay for an e-bike, but that's it. If you can't legally ride a motorcycle on the trail or legally drive your car on it, you can't ride your e-bike there. So again, for example, you're out in the middle of nowhere and you see a mountain bike trail, no, you can't really ride that. You can't go on a single track trail, and you can see why, because that's extra work. There's a little different traction with the tire. They can damage the tire. E-bikes,
damage the trail?
They can damage the trail. Yes, did I say tire?
Yeah,
I did. So I'm going to put a link to all of this, but how about BLM Lam? They've announced some future changes to their rules regarding e-bikes in some parts out west, and those changes may permit users being able to use low-speed e-bikes on their roads and trails. They're so popular, you're going to see them being used more and more. But in general, if it's a paved trail, like one of those normal rail-to-trails that you see, or trails-to-rails, rails-to-trails, bike trails that are around, most of those are paved. If they're paved, you can use them. If they're not paved, it might be a little dicey. I'd call the trail authority in that area. But I don't think you'll have too many problems in finding a place at all. They're all over the place, really, where you can ride them.
I think that as there are more and more e-bikes, people are going to be looking at them more.
Oh, my gosh. And did you know?
I mean, they're going to be saying,
Oh, you think so?
Yeah.
Well, it might be like drones. You know, when drones first started, everybody's using them, and then everybody got upset with them, and more laws came. But I sure hope not, because I love our e-bikes. And
I do, too.
They are so much fun.
Some of us be out there going as fast as they can on these little trails.
Well, that's one of the things. It can become a safety hazard, because you're going 20 miles an hour. If you're going downhill, you can go a lot faster with them. Now, some of the mountain bikers are, too, but in general, keep your e-bike off a single track, mountain bike trail, places where non-motorized vehicles are prohibited. You can put them on any place where there's a paved trail, and in many of the organized rails to trail system, you can also use it.
And I think the purists, those that really are into a whole bunch of gears, you know, are not going to want e-bikes.
Well, you know, we all got to share.
So, we all got to share.
So check the show notes. I'm going to put a link to that resource I was telling you about. It's in under rvlifestyle.com/266, and you should be able to find it. This part of the RV podcast brought to you by Battle Born Batteries, makers of quality, safe, reliable lithium batteries that can be installed in just about every RV. I tell you, I am so impressed by our Battle Born Batteries. We have 400 watts of solar on the roof. And the solar feeds into our Battle-Born batteries through a solar controller. And it is just this perfect balance. I mean, I was looking the other day. Now, of course, we're down in Florida, where normally the sun is shining. And as we're recording this, it's raining and cloudy out there. But
and going to be for 3 days.
For 3 days. So there you go. I'll have to go check it tonight and see how my batteries are. But I'll leave the batteries on, you know, at night when we're in the RV at night and when we're boondocking. And I may drop the battery use down. We use a CPAP machine. We watch a little TV. What else do we do? We have the lights on. We charge our computers. We don't use a ton of extra stuff there. Sometimes we'll use the microwave I heat my coffee with it for 3 minutes, but not much. So at the end of the morning, I'll come out and I'll be down to 60, 70% of my battery. And by 1-2 in the afternoon, those lithium batteries are all charged up to 100%. I just love these battle boards. I mean, I can go on and on like that. But the thing about a lithium battery is that, they are so much more efficient. They charge faster. They charge fuller. They're longer lasting. You can use them longer than AGM or gel batteries. They're maintenance free. I mean, totally maintenance free. And the folks at Battleborn, they are familiar with almost all existing RVs out there, Class A, Class C, Class B, cab over campers, whatever it is. They're experts, and they can probably help you find exactly what you need just to be able to drop in a pair of Battleborns, or one or two or three or four, however you want, wherever your house batteries are now. They'll be able to set you up with that. They can help you get the right cabling, the right inverter, the right charger, solar control. You need to check them out, and you can do that by going to rvlifestyle.com/lithium. rvlifestyle.com/lithium. All right, that's our little Halloween bumper here as we move to another segment. And this segment is our interview of the week. And this is a delightful couple that we met. We sure enjoyed meeting. We
met them out in California, and it was great meeting them.
We met Len and Sherry Johnson, who you're about to meet in a moment, and they are a remarkable couple. And they have quite a story to tell you. You'll be interesting to know what happened. They're both in their mid-60s, and Len has been an engineer. He's been a contractor. He is an aviation enthusiast, as you'll hear, and he had a devastating injury that he suffered in an airplane crash, and there's a story you'll hear all about that as well as we get going here. But the reason I asked them on the podcast is, one, we were both so impressed by the determination that they had to embrace the RV lifestyle despite all these obstacles that followed that accident. And they are a great couple for us all to learn from about there's always a way. So without any further ado, let's get into our interview of the week system with the Johnsons. Well, Len and Sherry join us right now on the podcast from their home in Buena Vista, California, in Southern California. First of all, thank you guys so much for being a part of the podcast.
Well, thank you.
So, hi, Mike.
Hi, Sherry and Len. So let's kind of set the stage a little bit. I mentioned in the intro that we met each other at the California RV show a little while ago, and I was going to do a video, and actually, as I came back and listened to the story and started thinking about it, it's much more involved than just a video. And I want to start with talking about so many people dream of freedom. They worry about being bored in retirement, or they've worked hard all their life, and they've looked forward to having some fun out there on the road. And well, they have so many excuses. Not enough money, not enough time, not sure where to go, can't find the right RV. They're all excuses. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about you guys. You are out there doing it right now in not the most ideal RV. Why don't you tell us what kind of an RV you have and why?
Well, we have a wheelchair van, the same one that we got so that I could travel with Sherry. It's a Toyota Sienna, and it's been raised, and the floor has been lowered, and it has a ramp that comes out on the side. I have a large wheelchair. You remember seeing it, Mike.
And we'll put a picture in the show notes here for the podcast so everybody can see that. Yeah, it's a really big wheelchair, as a matter of fact.
Yes. Well, when we load it in, there's not a lot of room. But there's enough, because I sleep in the wheelchair when we travel anyway. So there's not any real reason why I can't be in the wheelchair van instead of a hotel room. So it doesn't really make much difference to me. And Sherry built her own bed with a couple of sheets of plywood. She made a support for it that fits around a kind of like a Tupperware
Sterilite three-drawer system.
Right. Yeah. And that's where we keep our clothes and other odds and ends that we need for the road. And then the bed rests on the rear seat and across that platform structure. And then there's a slab of foam across that. And Sherry finds it very comfortable. She doesn't roll around a lot, so she doesn't need a very wide bed. And even when it's in the van, I can still get in and out with my wheelchair without having to take it apart.
So you're using a wheelchair van as an RV, really. And I know you were looking for other RVs, and we talked, and we'll come back to this a little later on, but we talked about how hard it is to find ADA, American with Disabilities Act, compliant RVs out there, isn't it?
It sure is, especially in the small size that we were looking for. We wanted to be in a van that would offer fuel economy that was something close to or even exceeding what we get in our Sienna. And that's possible with the Sprinter chassis and even with a couple of the other chassis with the diesel engine.
It just needs some work, and nobody is commercially doing this, I don't think, right now, are they?
No, not that I know of. A couple of vans have nice wide cargo sides, and so you can put in an elevator to pick up the van or pick up the wheelchair and bring it in. But as far as one that's already built that way, I haven't seen a small RV that is.
Well, it would have been so easy for you guys to say, well, we can't do this. We can't travel. What's the mindset that you had that said, yes, we can. We just have to adjust it to our abilities. Talk about that, Sherry. You first, and then you, Lynn.
Well, we've been pretty housebound for about a decade now. Lynn's accident was 11 years ago next month. And I don't know. I just got a bee in my bonnet that said, I don't think we want to sit here in our lazy boys for the rest of our lives. And it would be really nice to get out and see some of the beautiful country. And we have friends and family strewn all over the country that we would love to touch base with. And, you know, some people you kind of would like to go and see them for a meal and drive on, and others you'd like to spend a couple of weeks with, you know. So we just were trying to figure out a way that we could do it on our very limited budget.
And we should probably have you share with everybody right now, Len, just briefly, what was that accident? And we'll get into that in a moment, because that's really a huge story I want to cover here in a minute. But what was the accident, and what is your physical condition now?
Well, I was in an airplane crash, a single engine airplane that I built myself. And I broke my neck in the crash and received a spinal cord injury. So I'm an incomplete quadriplegic. And what that means is my spinal cord is intact, but it's damaged. So some signals don't go through and others do.
Now, you can stand briefly, as I understand, for a little bit, but that probably will deteriorate with age and time. Is that how I heard you right the other day?
That's my understanding, and it seems to be the case. In 10 years, I peaked about 2 years after the accident, and I'm not quite as strong now as I was then, so I expect that to continue.
So, Len, you're in your wheelchair. You and Sherry are sitting in your home, and you're saying, wait a minute. Life is getting us by here. We want to go out there. We have a wheelchair van, and we're going to make it into an RV. What was your mental turning point to go out and do that? Did you have any doubts about it, or did you just say, we're going to go do this?
Well, I'd say I had a lot of doubts about it, but Sherry did a lot of research online, and she came back and told me, hey, wait a minute, we can do this. And she persuaded me, and we are able to do it.
Now, I want to get to the story of how you became disabled. And it's quite a story. You mentioned that you built your own single-engine airplane, and it was a rather unique aircraft. And talk us through the feat you did with that airplane, and then the accident. How did it all start?
Okay, well, I shopped around looking for the right kind of airplane, and I settled on an airplane called an AeroCanard. There's another airplane like it called a Cozy Mark IV. And those two airplanes, either one would have worked. So I found one online where another builder had begun the airplane, had gathered the pre-molded parts from AeroCanard Corporation, and he had started building. but he wanted to get rid of the project and start with something else. So I bought the project from him, and I finished the airplane. It took several years to do.
He started out in our garage, started working on the wings in our two-car garage that we had at the time.
Yeah, it pretty much filled up the garage. And then when I got to the point where I wanted to put the wings on, it had to go to an airplane hangar on an airport. And so I got a shared hangar situation and finished up the building. It's a very fast airplane. It would go 200 miles an hour flat out, and had a range of close to 1,000 miles.
So you get this thing built after 2 years, and you decided on a pretty ambitious flight and a proof of concept, I guess, of that vehicle. What was that? Share that with the audience.
The small airplanes like this one use an engine technology that goes way back. It goes all the way back to the 40s. They are air-cooled, and they require a low-lead fuel. The lead is in there to keep the engine happy. It provides some lubricity, and without it, the engine wears too much. So I thought, if we could get away from the low lead fuel and still use the same engine, that would be great. So I decided on normal butanol, which is a three carbon alcohol, and butanol is kind of oily, but it still has a flash point that's relatively low. That means that it will burn in one of these engines once the fuel is up close to 100 degrees.
Could we call this like a biofuel? Would that be an accurate description for it?
Yes, of course. It's made in a process. It isn't mined or explored for like oil is. This actually comes from growing plants.
All right. So you have this airplane that's going to fly on a new kind of fuel for it, a kind of a biofuel. And what was the goal that you set off, and what did you accomplish with it?
The goal was to prove that the fuel would work and that the engine would function normally with the fuel. And in order to do that, I set up two fuel caches across the country, one in Amarillo and the other in Memphis. And I sent 55 gallons of fuel to each location. I carried a little extra fuel in my airplane. And I determined that there had been no one to fly all the way across the country on biofuel yet. So I was the first. So I set up the flight and modified my engine a little bit. I added a small header tank with gasoline because when it's cold out, the normal butanol, which the flash point is up around 100 degrees, doesn't really burn very well. So I would inject a little bit of gasoline from the header tank into the gas.
So you made this trip across country. How long did it take you?
It took several days. I had to stop off a couple of different locations on my way across. My son-in-law and daughter and grandkids live in Memphis, so I wanted to stop there. And I had a little trouble with the spark plugs in a couple places. I had to stop and work that out. But it took a few days.
But you did it. Sherry, you must have been on pins and needles and yet so very, very proud.
Oh, my goodness, yes. When he landed at Kitty Hawk and met with the First Flight Foundation, I thought my heart would burst with pride. You know, I was just so proud of him for this accomplishment. And they actually did a back page article in the Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine on him. And the First Flight Foundation, when they greeted him at Kitty Hawk, gave him a replica of the Wright Brothers Memorial.
This is awesome. So a roaring success. And now you're coming back, Len. And this is where the story reaches a climax. Tell us what happened.
Well, this is where it takes kind of a left turn. I stopped in Memphis again and then went to St. Charles, Missouri, which is where I grew up. And a couple of my best friends still live there. So I met them, and I have a sister that lives in Defiance, which is close to St. Charles. And we all visited together, visited my favorite restaurant for pizza called Pio's in St. Charles. I think I'll give them a plug.
Might as well. Yeah.
And then when I took off, I had checked the weather, and I was supposed to be 2 hours ahead of a storm front that was coming into the Midwest. And I wanted to get ahead of it so I could get back down to Texas, where I was supposed to go to a garden party and meet some potential investors. On my way there, when I got close to the Lake of the Ozarks, as often happens in the Midwest, the weather started to come up around me. So I ran into some moderate to severe clear air turbulence. Now, when a pilot says severe, that means you can't keep the shiny side up. You don't have any control anymore. The weather pretty much takes over. So I was at that point where I was between being able to control it and not being able to control it. And so I had to land it. I had to make an emergency landing. And I did that, but the field that I landed on, when I reached it, I didn't have enough energy to fly around and determine where the runway was and how I could best land. I just had to take what I could get. And it turned out that was sideways on the airport, and there wasn't enough room on the taxiway that I was on to stop. And so I was still doing probably in excess of 60 miles an hour when I hit a pole on the other end, tore one wing off, spun the airplane around, and I hit another pole, which tore the other wing off, and spun it again, and I hit a bollard on my front of the airplane, tore the front off. So the entire airplane was gone except for my feet. My feet were the farthest forward, and flipped the airplane upside down, and I slid to a stop maybe 25 feet or so from the house that I was trying to avoid.
Wow.
And my fuel is in the tanks that are right next to the cabin. They're called strakes. The strakes were broken open, so there was about 27 gallons of aviation fuel on the ground, and some of that, where my windbreaker had been torn open on the shoulder, got splashed on me, and so my sleeve was full of aviation fuel. And there was a smoking hot engine 6.5 feet behind me. But the airplane did not catch fire. I consider that to be a miracle in itself. The plane came to rest between the fire department and the police station. So there were people on site within just a few minutes. I was unconscious. And they started to dig me out. I was wrapped up in a bunch of wires, and there were bits and pieces of the plane all over the place. So they started cutting through to me to get me out of there. And I started coming to, and I was coming from, surprisingly, a very comfortable place. I felt warm and happy and loved, and I was good there. I was ready to just let go. But a voice came to me, said, "Not yet." And so I struggled to come to. And at first I heard voices, and it took me a while to identify them or even where I was. And then I realized I'd been in a plane crash, and these were my rescuers. And so I started to talk to them. And the first thing I asked them to do was to call Sherry. And I gave them her phone number.
Good for him.
And that's probably what saved me, because I always called her right before I took off to let her know I was about to leave and make sure everything's okay and let her hear my voice. Well, I forgot to do it on this day because I had people in St. Charles saying goodbye, including a reporter. And so I forgot to call her. And this was the one time I forgot, and it was the time that the plane went down.
Wow. That's an amazing story. I know what followed were a long period of rehab. How long were you in rehab, and what was that like?
Altogether, it was close to 4 months in hospital, and I started out in Springfield. They life flighted me to a trauma center there, and I had to have spinal cord surgery. They fused C4 through C7 and saw the spinal cord injury and told Sherry I probably wouldn't walk again. And when I came to, I had spinal shock. That's something that happens in a spinal cord injury when signals won't go through that area. And so I was almost completely paralyzed at that point. And very gradually, things started coming back. We called them returns. And so within, like I said, about 2 years, I was as far as I was going to get. And that left me with something called Brown Sequard, which means I have sensory deprivation on my left side and a weakness on my right side. But I have just enough left to be able to stand up and walk.
Well, I met you just a couple weeks ago shopping for RVs, and that takes us full circle back here to what the main topic of this podcast, of course, is, which is freedom and fun, and not letting situations and circumstances hold you back. With that kind of a story, where we sense the commitment of both of you and your perseverance, would you give some advice to people out there, Len and Sherry, who have always wanted to go out in an RV, but you know they say, well, circumstances aren't just right. Talk about your dreams.
Circumstances are never just right, are they, Mike?
Never. Never. That's lesson one, right?
Yeah.
Even if you go out and buy an RV, there are going to be problems with your first RV and your second RV and your last RV. So there will always be issues, and there will always be things that could be different or better. But the question is, can you be comfortable? And the answer is yes, we can. Can you deal with the adversity? Like, for instance, if it's cold inside of a wheelchair van, there are heaters that work and can be used inside. Can you carry enough water and food? Clearly you can. There are coolers that will stay cool for a couple of days at a time. There are many ways that you can overcome adversity.
Sherry, your thoughts?
Well, your website, along with several others and your YouTube channel, were very instrumental in my getting really enthusiastic about doing this because, like I said, we've been sitting around for like 10 years and we need to, you know, just for our mental health sake, be out and about a little more. We went up to Los Alamos, California, which is just a little north of Solvang, and heard an old friend of mine from just after high school. I used to sing in a band with him, and he's still in a band, even though he's a retired CHP captain, or actually assistant chief was his last promotion. And so we went up there and spent the night there and got to see the band and enjoyed the Los Alamos Day Parade the next day and before we came home. And in November, we have plans to go see some of Len's friends from high school in a band that they're in. So it's turned out to be a real delight, you know, to be able to see some old friends and not have to pay a lot of money for a hotel.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the advantages of boondocking in a wheelchair van. It doesn't look like a motorhome, and you don't need hookups. So there are lots of places. You should always get permission before you park somewhere, because you don't want a policeman waking you up in the middle of the night and telling you to move. But if you have permission, you can park just about anywhere if the ground's fairly level.
Well, my hope is that we find you guys an RV that I know that there are upfitters out there, and there's a pretty big market of people who have various disabilities and would love to RV if they can find a way out. You've given them one way, just do it with whatever you have. But last thing about perseverance. I remember as we left you in California, you said something, Sherry, to the effect that you make the best of it, and where there's a will, there's a way.
Absolutely.
You guys really believe that after all you have been through as you're out there. Would you tell somebody else who may be thinking that dream is beyond me that they can do it too?
Well, it's very easy to sit back in your chair and think, this is it. This is what I have for the rest of my life. And I actually had that mindset for a while, but the more I discovered about the RV lifestyle, I really just became very enamored of it. And like Glenn said, you know, there's good and bad, you know, in everything. And it doesn't matter if you're in a sticks and bricks home or whether you're in an RV, you're going to have issues that you deal with.
So. We should point out that when I was still healthy and still earning, we had a Class A motorhome for several years. And we used it quite a bit, but we knew we didn't want to do that again. For one thing, in our position, having more than one vehicle just isn't practical. And for another, it's rather hard to find one of those that is adapted to a wheelchair as well. And there just isn't enough room inside of them for the wheelchair to move around, so I would have to walk. And I need a special chair with the ability to raise my legs, and just all sorts of things would interfere with getting it right. And we thought, well, we don't really need one of those. We already have what we can use, and it's very economical, and we can be comfortable in what we have.
Well, I have so enjoyed meeting you two, and I know our RV podcast audience is very happy to meet you guys too. The one thing that'll make it better for me is when we camp together someplace, and let's make that happen in the next year and spend some quality time around a campfire. And I thank you so much for spending time with us on the RV podcast and sharing your story of finding freedom and fun no matter what out there in the RV lifestyle. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Len and Sherry Johnson, and I'm sure you will enjoy looking at them, seeing their photos and the show notes for this episode. And we'll also put a special YouTube video version of this interview up as well, and a link to kind of a YouTube story that Len created from stills of that plane disaster he had. But great couple to meet. You know?
And it kind of makes you stop your whining.
Stop your whining. No matter what, there is a way. The interview of the week is brought to you by SunshineStateRVs.com, where every new motor home is delivered to the customer free anywhere in the continental U.S. Sunshine State RVs, they have been a loyal sponsor here of the podcast for years now. And we've gotten to know Nick Schmidt and the crew over there and just have really enjoyed their companionship at some of the RV shows that we've attended. We've also got a chance to really get a good look at the way Sunshine State RVs works and treats customers. And I want to tell you that this is a reputable dealership that works with integrity, as their many, many customers will attest. They have the largest selection of used small motorhomes that you will find anywhere in North America. And we're talking about from the early 90s to the current year, they have almost every kind of used motorhome that you're going to want. From the popular brands out there, Pleasure Way, Winnebago, Leisure Travel Vans, Coachman, Road Trek, they've got them used in stock right now on their lot. And that's a great way to get into the whole RV lifestyle. Start with a used one. And you'll find that every used one that Sunshine State sells has gone through a very very thorough 172-point inspection. They make sure that all the mechanical and all the manual systems are in top condition, that every RV they sell is road tested. They make sure it runs and drives the way it should. Now, they also sell a huge selection of not just used, but new motorhomes. We're talking from outfits like the Winnebago Travato, the Winnebago Era, Coachman, American Patriot, the Fleetwood IROC, and many more new motorhomes as well. So whether it's new or used, you owe it to yourself to do a quick check. Just go to sunshinestatervs.com. That's sunshinestatervs.com.
Time now for Off the Beaten Path,
a unique RV podcast travel suggestion you probably won't find in a guidebook. Here's Mike.
And Off the Beaten Path regular reporters Tom and Patty Burkett join us with this week's report.
Hi, Jennifer and Mike. We were standing on the porch of a National Park Visitor Center staring at a sign hung above the entrance door. It was a half-circle dial with an arrow. On the left, at what would be the lowest in its range, it read All Clear. At the midpoint was the word Severe, and at the top of the scale was War Zone. In big letters across the bottom were the words Mosquito Meter. Ranger Eric, watching us chuckle at the meter, said, "Hey, it's no joke. Lots of folks call us up and ask what the meter says before they come out here." The meter can be found in Congaree National Park, one of the lesser-known sites in the park system.
Located about 15 miles southeast of Columbia, South Carolina, it sits at the heart of an international biosphere reserve of the same name. The entire park is a designated wilderness, more than 25,000 acres of it, and many square miles of surrounding countryside contribute to the complete reserve. Two newspaper editors, both of whom were sportsmen, began to promote the idea of protecting the area in the early 1960s. By 1976, it was a national monument, and it was designated a national park in 2003.
When it finally became a park, it had already been a biosphere reserve for more than 20 years. Both the Congaree River and Cedar Creek run through this lush and mosquito-infested bottomland forest. It's the largest tract of virgin bottomland forest left in the United States and has the largest tract of uncut deciduous temperate forest in the world. The largest known examples of 15 tree species can be found on its acres, including a persimmon that tops out over 200 feet and many oaks that rise more than 100 feet above the wet forest floor.
As you might expect, both the tree cover and the insect food supply make it a haven for birds, and it is internationally known for both variety and population. There are more than 25 miles of hiking trails, almost entirely flat, more than 2 miles of boardwalks, and an excellent canoe trail along Cedar Creek. The entire park is open to canoeing and kayaking, subject to seasonal flooding and other safety concerns.
Unless you've been in a forest like this, it's hard to convey what it's like. The trees tower overhead, their leaves many dozens of feet above your head. Very little vegetation grows at ground level, so there's a vast sense of spaciousness interrupted only by the giant trunks rising into the distance above you. Birds sing, insects hum, and something is always falling from up there somewhere. Acorns, leaves, twigs, you name it. In the water or on the wet ground, you can see snakes, turtles, lizards, frogs, and little fish. You might easily imagine yourself transported back 1,000 years to the time when only Native Americans hunted here.
One of the great treats of visiting here can be seen in May, when the synchronous fireflies come out. Battle for a spot in the lottery at Great Smoky Mountains if you like, or visit Congaree for a much less crowded experience. You can walk the boardwalk through the firefly area at your leisure. The limited parking does tend to fill up, though, so we'd suggest you come early, take a nap, check out the visitor center, and be in a prime spot when glow time begins. It's nature's world out here, so don't forget the insect repellent, but don't miss the chance to stroll through this forest primeval out here off the beaten path.
And that wraps up another episode of the RV Podcast with Mike and Jennifer Wendland.
New episodes are released every Wednesday, and the best way to stay connected is to subscribe to the RV Podcast.
We're in all the popular podcast apps, and you can also listen on the RVLifestyle.com travel blog.
Till next time, happy trails, fellow travelers. We'll be looking for you down the road.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of the RV Podcast. We'll see you, as always, next Wednesday on the RV Podcast. Happy trails. Bo says bye, too.